On our show today, we're going to take a little different tack. Instead of looking at the genocide directly, the genocide is still going on as I am recording this on June 28th. But today, instead, we're going to take a look at some predictions by relative experts. First, we have Jeffrey Sachs, an economist. He is going to tell us about what he thinks the U.S. position in the world is these days. And following that, we're going to have an editorial by Shahid Bolson, who is an Islamic analyst. He grew up, was raised in the United States, and he is expatriate at this point, I believe, in Egypt. But Shahid Bolson is paying close attention to events around the Israel occupation of Palestine, and he will give his commentary regarding what he thinks is the case with Israel now going forward. So first, Jeffrey Sachs. This was recorded June 16th. And the Shahid Bolson editorial titled Message to Israelis is dated June 20th, 2025.
U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump has been defined by an America First agenda. But what does this mean in a world where the old centers of hegemonic power are shifting? This week on Upfront, I'll be speaking to renowned economist and director of Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Development, Jeffrey Sachs. Jeffrey Sachs, thanks so much for joining us on Upfront.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You said that we're now living in a multipolar world, with major powers like Russia, China, India asserting their own influence, whether that's economic or political. You've also said that the U.S. sort of state is in decline. Can you explain why you think that is and how that's come to pass where we have this new arrangement of power?
We have a new arrangement of power because these other parts of the world have made a lot of economic and technological progress. So China was a poor country 40 years ago. It is now a quite wealthy and technologically advanced country. I'd say it's at the cutting edge of many of the most important technologies. How did they get there? Very hard work, very high investment rates, very good strategy, serious planning. They thought ahead, they worked hard at it, and they were successful. This is the main fact. A second fact is a basic technological fact, which we kind of understood in the Cold War and kind of forgot after 1991, but it's a real truth every moment of our lives. And that is because of nuclear weapons and because other countries have a lot of them, we can't defeat those countries. So the world's intrinsically multipolar in the sense, don't mess with another nuclear superpower, can really wreck your day. And we forgot that after 1991. Why 1991? That was the year that the Soviet Union dissolved into 15 states. And the American elite said, okay, now we really are all alone. We are the world's sole superpower. We treated Russia absolutely stupidly, abused our power, which was real, but abused it to the point where we ended up having a full-fledged war. It's in a way a proxy war in Ukraine, but it's a war between the United States and Russia, actually. It's not described that way in our press, but it is that way. And the point I'm making is you can't win a war like that, because if you win, you lose. Russia has thousands of nuclear warheads. It's not going down. And if you lose on the battlefield with conventional, you lose again. Yeah. So this whole Ukraine adventure was forgetting that there was already intrinsically a multipolar world simply because there are multiple powers with many nuclear arms that can ruin your day, that can end up destroying our country and the world. So the fact of the matter is the United States is 4.1% of the world's population. We have 335 million people, approximately. The world is 8.1 billion people. There are a lot of other people. They don't see it the way that Washington sees it, that Washington runs the show. But I know Washington. Washington, till this day, has the delusion that they run the show.
Mm. Does that delusion make it hard for the United States to maintain its current footing or even regain power?
You can't regain unipolarity, or you can't even regain the position the United States was in 30 or 40 years ago in relative terms, because China is China now, an advanced, technologically sophisticated, militarily powerful country. Not an enemy, in my view, at all, but so powerful. We better not go to war with China, that's for sure. It would end up either blowing up the world or defeating us or doing something completely...
No good outcomes.
Totally disastrous. Do the American policymakers understand those realities? Do they understand that India has changed? Because India was, in the American mind, an impoverished country that we could bring around to be enemies of China and so forth, which is what they try to do. They don't understand India is making remarkable advances economically and technologically, is a nuclear superpower, has a space program that is very active, is in the forefront of digital technologies. So this is the truth of the world. But we don't understand it. We still make demands. We think we can make trade wars, or we can launch real wars, or we can threaten other countries with this and that. It doesn't work.
Under Trump, the U.S. has withdrawn from the World Health Organization, the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Paris Climate Agreement. He's also imposed significant tariffs on allies like Canada and the European Union. What's your take on the broader impact of these kinds of moves?
The idea of the Trump administration is we shouldn't be bound by things like the UN. That's stupid. We shouldn't be bound by treaties. We are sovereign. We have power. We should use our power. This is, in my view, not very sensible as a kind of high-level approach. It's a little bit like saying you go to the traffic light and traffic light's red and you say, I'm walking anyway. Who's going to tell me what to do? Well, the light's there for a reason. It's good to actually regulate the flows in all directions. Trade rules are not to harm the United States. Trade rules are to act like a traffic light, to make sure that the trade flows in a systematic way according to rules that are common to all countries. So I think the basic conceptual idea that we don't like the UN, we're not going to be bound by any of these stupid organizations, we are America.
Is there any legitimacy to these some of these moves? For example, Trump will say that the UN Human Rights Council is unfair to the United States. It places an unfair burden on them that it doesn't on other nations, or that the climate accords are unreasonable given what they're asking. What do you say to those kinds of claims?
Well, when it comes to climate change, one basic point, a couple basic points. First, climate change is real. Second, it's really dangerous. Third, it is accelerating. It's worse than the scientists thought it would be at this point, because in the last few years, the rate of the Earth's warming has dramatically increased, and the scientists are trying to figure out what's going on, but we're reaching very dangerous levels on the planet. That's why all the forest fires, the Category 5 hurricanes, many, many terrible things are happening around the world. So that's all true. Then comes President Trump's claim that the Paris Agreement is against the United States. Paris Agreement doesn't mention the United States. So it's not against the United States. It's an agreement of 196 countries. All the rest, that we should be sitting down with Russia, with the Saudis, with Canada, with China, with India, with other big emitting countries and saying, all of us, we got a problem. What do we do? That's what we should be doing, not walking out the door. And not saying, you know what, we're just going to live with it. Climate changes. This is actually doesn't pass muster if you take even just a little bit of a careful look at this. What the United States is doing inadvertently, I'm sure that Trump doesn't appreciate this, but the United States is giving the technological lead over to China. It's handing it over, saying, we're not going to get into things like electric vehicles. We're not going to get into solar. And so that's, we're going to drill, baby, drill. So you have the lead of the future economy of the 21st century, which China says, okay, we will produce most of the electric vehicles in the world. Thank you very much. We will produce fourth generation nuclear, the modular nuclear. We will produce wind, solar, hydro. We'll have smart digital grids. That's all the things China's doing right now.
Let's talk a little bit on the domestic front. In your 2018 book, A New American Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism, you wrote that Trump's America First agenda was really about putting white America first, that he's part of a global wave of anti-immigrant and racist politics. Recently, Trump unleashed ICE agents on undocumented immigrants, which, of course, sparked heavy protests in California. There's clearly resistance to his policies. But do you think that resistance is enough to shift anything?
No, not right now. I think, but we are in for many years of instability in the United States. This is not one day, one week, one month. This is a pretty deep social divide. I do believe if you have to put it down into one fundamental concept, it is racism in the end. This is about the changing racial composition, changing ethnic composition of America, which is becoming less white over time and a lot more immigrant population, foreign-born and so forth. I happen to like that. I love New York City. You hear English once in a while, but you hear everything. And it is that diversity which I think is the greatest strength of America. But that's not the view of Trump's base. And that, I believe, is probably the fundamental motive force. It would be denied, but I think it's the fundamental motive force. There is a point, by the way, that I do agree with the rhetoric, not any of the action of Trump. And I think any country should have borders that are regular and policed. I don't think a rich country like the United States can have open borders. 1 billion people would show up. That would not be manageable. That would not be right. It would not work. And so I don't think that the alternative is to say, no, we don't have any borders. I think what is awful about the way things are done is the cruelty of it. And part of the game of this administration is cruelty. They're trying to shock and awe. They're trying to scare the hell out of people. And they are, by the way, scaring the hell out of people. They are arresting my students. I don't like that, of course. I mean, nobody can like that. And it is to instill the fear factor. That does not make America great. That is really sad. And it's not a superficial thing, and it's not something that's going to go away in a short period of time.
You've spoken often about integrating African countries more deeply into the global economy, and you've advocated for the African Union to lead the continent's development through really greater global integration. Given how entrenched global power structures are, how does that become a reality? How does that go from vision to reality?
So, great question, and I will predict absolutely that the next decades will be very positive decades for Africa.
Really?
I'm very optimistic, actually, because I think the new technologies will allow for a lot of leapfrogging, a lot of economic development. I think Africa countries have a lot of work to do to make that happen, but I think they're going
to. What kind
of
work needs to happen?
The main thing, absolutely get every kid in school, get them a digital device, get them good online materials for education, train the young people of Africa. This is number one, two, three, four, and five of economic development. And it raises some issues because very poor countries don't have the means at hand to get all their kids in school.
Yeah.
And so they literally cannot fund that by themselves. So I'm trying to work on financing models, ways that they can do it. Basic idea, quite simple. Borrow today, but on very long-term, low interest.
Oh, that makes me nervous, Jeff.
No, but I'm going to tell you why. Because the next generation is going to be a lot richer if they get that education. The returns to education are extremely high. They're about 20% rate of return of putting a kid from, say, kindergarten up through, if you do a tertiary, if you do two-year or four-year post high school, you get about a 20% compound return. If you borrow at 2 or 3% real interest rates, and you do that for 40 years, where's the money come from to repay the loan? A wealthy economy.
That sounds great, and I love the model. I think what I'm concerned with is that history demonstrates a different kind of outcome. I think about countries like China, for example, that have invested billions into African infrastructure.
Yeah.
Ostensibly to produce growth and development in the country. It seems like
it's working.
Yeah, but look at a place like Zambia.
It's working, but I'll tell you what mistake they make, and I tell them all the time, by the way, which is that they gave Zambia an eight-year loan or a 10-year
loan. I was
going to
say, they spend so much money on debt repayment that they have to cut social services, health care, all this stuff to pay the debt back.
Completely correct.
But that's kind of the history of Africa.
Yeah, but the mistake is, and it's China's mistake also, it's not a malevolent mistake. It's not a trap. It is a mistake, though. You cannot finance development on a 10-year loan. Development is a 40-year process. It's not a 10-year process. And we are so nasty to tell a poor country that maybe gets the kid from kindergarten to ninth grade, now you pay back the loan. I'm sorry, the kid's still in ninth grade.
Right.
So you need 40-year debt. And what I'm saying to the Chinese government officials who listen to me and at least hear my arguments is just extend these loans for at low interest, but make this not due today. That's crazy. Make it due 25, 30 years
from now. Are they willing to do that? I mean, I could see why these superpowers don't want to do that, but it's in their interest to get faster returns.
I think that they are willing to do that, actually.
Okay.
So that is my idea. The other idea, which I don't like, which is the IMF's idea, I'm sorry to say, is, well, Mr. Finance Minister, it would just be great for all those kids to be in school, but you don't have the money. And I know you'd love a little electricity, but so sorry, there's no money there. So that, to my mind, is the real poverty trap, which is you don't finance the absolute core investment. But coming back to Africa's prospects, when I do the arithmetic on my spreadsheets, I find that Africa can grow 7% to 10% per year for the next 40 years. In 1980, with its 1.4 billion people, China took off. India, with its 1.4 billion people, now 1.5, it started about 20 years after China in rapid growth, around 2000. I want Africa to start now. It's also got 1.5 billion people. It's the same size, actually.
Right. But you know, the additional challenge of being multiple countries as opposed to singular nations.
Well, you know, in 1885, in that very polite Congress of Berlin, the European countries, with no Africans present, took the map and divided it among themselves and colonized the whole damn continent and left it, in the end, as 55 separate countries on one continent where there's one China and there's one India.
Right.
That makes governance hard. And so my point about governance in Africa is be a union, really, have an Africa continental free trade area. When you plan your infrastructure, don't plan it 55 times. Get that rail to connect across Africa. Get the highways to connect. Get the fiber to connect. Think of it as one country, basically. Think of it truly as a union.
Let's move to something less controversial. Let's talk Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, that one's an easy one.
the genocide in Gaza has been going on for a little over a year and a half now. Recently, we've seen a shift. Countries like France, the UK, Canada, even Germany's chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has been more critical of Israel. Given the scale of devastation, are we at a point where the response we're starting to see is a case of kind of too little, too late?
Well, it's shockingly late, this is for sure, because, you know, just on the official count, there are more than 50,000 dead, and mostly women and children.
Yeah.
So a genocide's been going on all this time, and Europe and the United States were either supporting it actively, as the United States has been doing, or supporting it tacitly by just standing by. Now they're saying something, they're murmuring, but God, it's still far too little, because what should be said, to my mind, is not only that this has to stop, and there was a vote in the UN Security Council just in recent days, 14 of the 15 countries said immediate ceasefire, because people are getting killed massively every day, civilians. But one vetoed it, the Trump administration. So first thing is, of course, stop this mass killing. But the second thing is recognize the state of Palestine. No doubt, no negotiations, no peace process, no baloney, no we need to get Israel to agree, because Israel will never agree. The problem, of course, is that Israel has a completely radical, I think genocidal, government with Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and they're mass murderers as far as I'm concerned. And their goal is not defeat Hamas. Their goal is to control everything. This is clear. They don't say, and I think it's the telltale point about Netanyahu, although if you press him, then he would acknowledge it. They don't say, we need to defeat Hamas, and then we're going to have a state of Palestine. They say, we need to defeat Hamas. Well, what after that? Well, it's none of your goddamn business. Right. And if you press hard, well, we're going to be there forever.
Well, recently, we've seen some tensions emerge between Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Boy, I hope so. I hope we're seeing some tensions.
I mean, Trump did not meet with him in his most recent trip to the Middle East, which seems like a big deal. Some people even said it was a snub.
I hope so. God, if there's anyone that deserves a snub, it's Bibi Netanyahu.
If that's true, does that change anything on the ground in terms of U.S. policy?
Look, the president needs to do one thing. Basically one thing and one thing only, and that's to drop the U.S. veto on a state of Palestine. Why is there not a state of Palestine according to international law? For one and only one reason, the U.S. vetoes it. Because membership in the United Nations goes through the U.N. Security Council. When it came up last year, the U.S. was the only veto. It was actually 12 in favor, 2 abstained, the United States vetoed. When it goes to the General Assembly, where there are 193 countries, about 185 say yes.
Yeah.
And when I added up the population of those 185, it is 95% of the world population saying yes. So President Trump snubbing Netanyahu is one thing, not liking him is another thing, but there's only one operational thing that counts. Stop vetoing Palestine's membership in the United Nations. And the point that I would make to President Trump and to the American people is this would be hugely beneficial for American national security, because it would bring peace to the Middle East. The reason the wars rage is that there is no state of Palestine. That leads to resistance. That leads to counter wars. That leads to Netanyahu's counter wars or calling on the United States to invade another country, as he has done repeatedly. If we want peace, which we do, the way to peace is a state of Palestine alongside the state of Israel, period, which 185 countries of the world support.
You've written about the U.S. belief in its need to dominate and the idea that historically the United States has seen itself as exceptional. In your book on American exceptionalism, which was published during the first Trump administration, you warned that this mindset was not only outdated but also dangerous. Are there any signs that the U.S.'s self-perception is shifting from the exceptionalist idea?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There are glimmers of hope. Our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said, and I nearly quote him, that we are now in a multipolar world. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. That is a very good statement. President Trump has said he can see President Putin's point of view that NATO should not enlarge to Ukraine. That is a very good statement. That is absolutely positive. I want him to recognize the same thing when it comes to the Middle East. I want the president to recognize the same thing when it comes to China. I want the president to make peace with Iran rather than following Bibi Netanyahu into some bombing mission against Iran. If those things happen, that would be the recognition that we have some limits, that we're in a multipolar world, and that we can't bomb our way out of it.
Hmm. Jeffrey Sachs, thanks so much for joining me on Upfront.
Oh, really great to be with you. Thanks.
And that was Jeffrey Sachs, recorded June 13th, 2025. Coming up, we have an editorial by Shahid Bolson, recorded June 20th, 2025.
Okay, well, you know, I had a video. I published a video about a year ago, more than a year ago. Titled something like "A Message to the Israeli People" or "To the People of Israel" or something like that. Until now, it's by far my most popular video. And I think that in that video, I was quite straightforward, and I think I was respectful in that video, and in that message. I told you the truth to the Israeli people. I told you the truth. So let me do it again. Because I think that you very badly need someone to tell you the truth. If more of you had listened, actually, and I did get a lot of positive comments from people who identified themselves as Israelis, but if more of you had listened to that first video, well, we might be in a very different place today, and you might be in a very different place today, but what has happened, and here we are, and here you are. So let me tell you where you are. First of all, let me tell you what you did, okay? You took a bucket, and you called that bucket Israel. That's what you did. And you filled that bucket with the blood of Palestinians. You filled it with the blood of Lebanese. You filled it with the blood of Syrians, with Iraqis, the blood of Iranians, the blood of Africans, even Afghanis, the blood of Egyptians, obviously. Yes, you filled that bucket with blood. And then you used that blood to start painting on the ground everything that you said was yours. That's what you did. You painted in their blood what you wanted to claim as your territory. But you painted yourselves into a corner. Yes, you did. You have painted yourselves into a very tight corner, and now you're stuck. You've painted your way out of having any feasible options. But all the while, Uncle Sam was cheering you on, wasn't he? He was helping you to keep that bucket full so you'd never run out of blood to paint with. He kept cheering you on, and he kept your bloody bucket full, and he watched you paint yourselves into a corner the whole time. Yes, Uncle Sam and his whole European team, which is the same team, by the way, that threw your people into the gas chambers. It's the same team that exiled you, that ostracized you, that abused you, and that mocked you, and that tormented you and your people for centuries, until they completely tried to annihilate you under the Nazis. That's the same team that's been cheering you on this whole time. That's the team. They've been watching you paint yourselves into a corner with the blood of the people of the region. And you were foolish enough. You know, you were foolish enough, or you were deluded enough, or you had such maybe an inferiority complex about those Europeans and about those Americans that you were just desperate for their approval. I don't know why you did what you did. Wallahi, I don't understand it. But you were fools to do it. And you ought to realize that now. You ought to realize that the people who hated you ever since they even knew about you, they didn't suddenly have a change of heart. No, they hated you then and they hate you now. And they have hated you the whole time while they were watching you and cheering you as you got yourselves trapped into a situation that you can't get out of. Because that's the situation that you're in. That's your situation right now. You're in a situation that you cannot get yourselves out of, and that's a fact. There's no viable exit for you now. I mean, think it through. I don't think you are. You know, I told you more than a year ago that they were egging you on to do things that were absolutely and irredeemably destroying your reputation as a people, as a nation. I mean, the damage is irreversible. Tens of thousands of people killed, innocent people killed in Gaza, 50,000. By the time that they actually have the real numbers, by the time we know the real numbers, you and I both know it's going to be over 100,000 people that you've murdered. More than that, probably, that you've slaughtered. So you see what they've done. They've turned you from being victims of their Holocaust against you into perpetrators of genocide. Look at that. What makes you think that the perpetrators of the Holocaust are not just trying to retroactively justify their crimes by turning you into genocidal monsters? You ought to think more deeply. I mean, do you understand that no one feels sorry for you now? That was your currency before, but no one feels sorry for you now. I mean, they're putting out AI English translations of Hitler on YouTube, and it doesn't get taken down. It gets shared. They've got people who used to say things quietly amongst themselves now saying out loud that Hitler had a point. And maybe he did what he did for a good reason. Imagine. We're not even talking about Holocaust denial anymore. We're talking about Holocaust justification being normalized because of your actions. That's because of nothing but your actions, Israel's actions. It's because of the genocide. It's because of the unhinged, unrestrained, illegal violence that you've committed across every border in the region, attacking Syria, attacking Lebanon, attacking Iran, attacking Iraq, attacking Yemen. Your great American and your great European cheerleaders have applauded you and have funded you into damnation. Do you understand me? They have applauded you and they have funded you until you now have become a hideous spectacle of a nation that the whole world despises. And you think that these are your friends. Until now. You think that these are your friends who saved you from the Nazis. Well, they're not doing anything but carrying on what Hitler left off, where Hitler left off. But they just made their approach more sophisticated. You know, Hitler used an axe and they use a scalpel. They've ruined you. I'm surprised that you can't see it. I mean, after more than 600 days of inhuman savagery in Gaza, I mean inhuman brutality, all of it live streamed, when the most bigoted, the most, you know, neo-Nazi white supremacist, openly Jewish-hating demagogue, after all of that, when he claims that your people are satanic and demonic, well, what's a good-hearted person supposed to say after what we've seen? I said they've turned you from Holocaust victims into genocidal killers in the public mind. All the blood that you're spilling is only whitewashing them of what they did to you for centuries. Can't you see that? You're justifying what they did to you. And because you insisted that Israel and Judaism are one and the same thing, that only ensures that every Jew now is going to bear the shame and bear the blame and bear the ignominy of what Israel has done and what Israel is doing. Oh, they've got you boxed in. And you let them box you in. I mean, look, Iran, let's talk about Iran. Let me tell you about your situation, your Iran situation. First of all, your whole claim all these decades, your whole rationale for why the United States had to keep giving you money, had to keep giving you weapons, why you were useful to launder American taxpayer money into the military-industrial complex, right? Why no one is supposed to object to that. No one is supposed to object to the billions and billions and billions of dollars of their money that went to your so-called defense instead of to their own schools, instead of to their own hospitals, their own roads, their own bridges, their own infrastructure. The whole reason that everyone was supposed to go along with that without any complaint was because you were supposed to be in perpetual existential crisis because you were surrounded by hordes of angry Arabs who wanted to drive you into the sea, angry, violent Muslims. So you were constantly under threat. And because, of course, people thought of you as Holocaust victims. So, of course, we have to protect you. The American people have to protect you, even if that really just means protecting defense industry profits. But the rationale worked, you know. The rationale worked because everyone thought, you know, poor little Israel was surrounded and in danger. Okay, Egypt made peace with you. Jordan made peace with you. Turkey made peace with you. The UAE made peace with you. Bahrain made peace with you. Sudan made peace with you. Morocco made peace with you. Now even Saudi Arabia say that they're willing to make peace with you. Lebanon is willing to make peace with you. Syria is willing to make peace with you. Even Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, on the other side of the world, they're also willing to make peace with you. You know, Hezbollah has been decapitated. And even Hamas is willing to step down, and they're willing to step aside, which means, in practical terms, disarming and disbanding and letting another authority take over Gaza. Another authority who will be willing to negotiate peace with you. So there's nobody left that you can claim threatens you except for Iran. And now, apparently, you're acting like you want to dismantle even that alleged threat. So no one's going to be left now to even justify why anyone needs to protect you anymore. I mean, I know you're trying to resuscitate ISIS in Syria, and you started that dumb little militia in Gaza, that Abu, what's his name? Abu Shabab, or whatever his name is. Obviously, this isn't going to go anywhere. This is ridiculous. So you think now that you want to go to war with Iran. You want to go after Iran, which you know you cannot defeat on your own. Your own people have said as much. Your own officials, your own military have said as much. You know that you need America to do that. But you understand, America entering the war means regional war. And you are in the region. I know you don't care about what happens to any other country in the region, but if a regional war kicks off, you better believe that Iran is going to unload everything they have on you. And if you think that America is going to be worried about protecting you in that scenario, you are sorely mistaken. The only thing that America is going to care about protecting, if that happens, is their own bases and their own interests in the Gulf. They're going to defend Saudi Arabia. They're going to defend the UAE. They're going to defend Qatar, because Iran is going to strike them too. No one's going to be trying to save you. Why should they? You don't have oil. You don't control vital shipping routes. What do you have? Your whole economic model is parasitic. And Donald Trump, remember, Donald Trump is transactional. So think that through. The GCC gives him billions, I mean, even potentially trillions of dollars. Meanwhile, Israel does nothing but beg for money. No one wants to protect you. If America enters the war, you ought to understand that it will only make things worse for you, not better. Can't you see that? Tel Aviv is going to be flattened. Your ports will be vaporized. You know, your little natural gas fields are going to be on fire. Your cities will be demolished. And yes, your people are going to flee. I mean, they're fleeing already. They're fleeing already by their tens of thousands. Some say 100,000 already sailed off on boats and yachts to Cyprus. They're all escaping the possibility that maybe they'll be hit by an Iranian rocket after just 1 week of conflict. You must be out of your mind if you think that America entering the war and escalating the war is going to be good for you in any way whatsoever. They want to finish you. Don't you understand that? Look, construction in your country, in Israel, has already stopped. It already stopped 600 days ago. When your buildings get damaged, they're staying damaged. Do you understand? Do you have any idea how much more damage Iran can absorb than you can absorb? Their country is 70 times larger than you. 70 times. Their army is at least 4 times larger than you. And their soldiers aren't on TikTok. They're not quitting. They're not refusing to serve. They're not getting taken off duty for mental problems. They're not committing suicide. They're not killing themselves. No, it doesn't even matter how much damage America could potentially do to Iran. You cannot sustain a fraction of what Iran can sustain, and that's just a fact. If this goes on for even just 6 months, you're looking at an economic toll on your economy of upwards of $165 billion. That's 35% of your GDP. Double that if it goes on for a year, and it can go on for a year. If it's a full-blown war and Iran starts to get replenishments of their artillery from Russia, China, North Korea, whatever, and if they reactivate their proxies, oh yes, it can go on. And yes, the fact of the matter is that your people all have somewhere else to go when things get bad. Iranians don't. Do you understand? Iranians don't even have to carry out a mass casualty attack in Israel. They don't have to focus on that. All they have to do is land one rocket in one building, and everyone in every apartment of that building is on a plane to New York. They're on a plane to Paris or to Moscow. They can literally depopulate your whole country just by targeting infrastructure, because at the end of the day, you're all pampered Westerners, after all. You're not trying to live without Wi-Fi and cappuccinos. You know it and I know it. You're not ready to die for the Zionist cause. I mean, be serious. And then there's the fact that, what do you think happens if they escalate the war? What do you think happens when American soldiers start dying for you? Listen, Americans don't even want to see American soldiers overseas supposedly dying for their own country in Iraq, in Afghanistan, or wherever else, according to the rationale that they give their soldiers and the soldiers' families. You notice that they didn't even send their own soldiers to go and fight in Ukraine against their arch enemy, Russia. I mean, firstly, what on earth makes you think that they're even going to be willing to fight and die for you when they don't even want to send their soldiers, like I said, to go fight and die supposedly for their own country, you know, in various military engagements around the world? What makes you think that you're not just going to get Ukrained out of existence by your best friend, Uncle Sam? They're willing to fight Russia down to the last Ukrainian. What makes you think that they're not going to be willing to fight Iran all the way down to the last Israeli? Wallahi, you're not reading the room at all. But if the United States does actually escalate and get into the war, and they actually do send their own soldiers, well, how does that play out? Think that through again. Now your country is not only going to be responsible for the blood of Palestinians, for the blood of Arabs, but mothers across the United States are going to hold you responsible for the blood of their sons and daughters. I'm telling you, they're not doing anything but set you up to be hated and disposed of. And you should be able to see it. I'm surprised that you can't, honestly. But maybe you're just so in love with the people who tormented you and tortured you for centuries that you just can't see it. I don't know what it is. But it gets worse. Because like I said, your people are going to flee. But also, like I said, you've made the whole world hate you now. So where exactly are they going to go? Now, we know that the U.S. Took in Nazi scientists after World War II, so they'll probably be willing to take in your top tech people, too. But what about the rest of you? What about the rank and file? The only way that they can escape is if they completely deny being Israeli. You know, I mean, I know most of them are atheists, and they only actually claim their Jewishness, so-called, to gain access to Israeli citizenship. But once they escape a war-torn Israel, they won't even want to claim that anymore, believe me. Again, because you stupidly insisted that Israel and Judaism are one and the same thing. So that left them with now the only choice that they have is to disavow their Israeliness. And in so doing, they're going to have to repudiate their Jewishness. Do you see? Netanyahu and his neocon white supremacist backers are destroying you as a nation, as a people. They're destroying you because they hate you. And they always have hated you, and you know this. There's no way that you don't know this. I mean, you got into bed with the Christian Zionists. And you and I both know that the Christian Zionists' whole motivation is to see you get slaughtered in their end times Armageddon porn fantasy. And you know that the main backers of Zionism back in the day in Europe were the most Jewish-hating segments of the power structure. So you know perfectly well, you haven't fooled yourselves. You know perfectly well that they have hated you this whole time. And now you can see where that's gotten you, trusting and depending on people who hate you. Honestly, this has got to be the most epic series of bad choices in history that you've made. And here's the biggest irony. You know what the biggest irony is? The biggest irony is that the only countries that would still potentially be safe for you are the Muslim countries, the Arab countries. The very countries that you've been saying all this time want to destroy you. Meanwhile, you literally hooked up with the people who have never done anything but try to destroy you, literally for hundreds of years. But the Muslims and the Arabs were always welcoming. They were always hospitable to you. They always gave you shelter. They always gave you safe haven. And now their countries are the only countries that might be willing to host you again. They're the countries that are going to rebuild Israel after people flee, after your people flee. Think about that. After the war that you think you want so badly. The irony is poetic. Yes, the Arabs and the Muslims are going to be the ones to rebuild. They will fund the reconstruction. They will pump in the investment. And the people who partnered with you in your self-destructive war against the Arabs and against the Muslims, those people are going to be partnering with us in those reconstruction projects. Oh, you're being tricked in every which way. I don't know, honestly, how you can't see it. I mean, don't you see how Trump's own crowd, his own crowd, the Tucker Carlson's, the Candace Owens, the Steve Bannons, and so on, well, they've been not so subtly opening the lid off of that repressed right-wing anti-Jewish vitriol for the last 600 days. No one's taking the fall for this but you, do you understand? You're taking the fall. And no one should have seen it coming better than you. You've watched them over the past. You've watched them. You've participated with them. Every single time they turned on someone that they committed crimes with, you know what I'm talking about. But you thought that they wouldn't do it to you for some reason. When they have the absolutely longest record of hating your people. You know, they did it to Saddam. They did it to Noriega. They did it to Mobutu. They did it to the Shah. They did it to Mubarak, to the Contras. I mean, on and on and on. But you thought they really loved you. Is that it? You thought they really loved you. You thought that they really loved you with all of their Nazi scientists, their KKK, and their dream of end times Jewish annihilation. You thought they loved you. You thought they'd never turn on you. Well, I mean, tell me, did you really think that when they were spreading all of that propaganda about how powerful AIPAC is and about how much the Jews control the media and how much the Jews control finance and how you supposedly run the world and what have you, are you telling me that you all thought that that was flattery? Complimentary? Did you think it was all pillow talk? No, they were setting you up to take the blame for everything that they used you to do. For all the crimes that they commissioned for you to commit on their behalf. You understand? Oh, they're going to sell you down the river, just like they've done to every other accomplice that they ever duped to commit heinous crimes on their behalf. The same as what you've done. That's what your whole country's history has been. But maybe you thought it was going to be different with you because you're Western, because you're white, because you're European or what have you. But I mean, open your eyes. So are the Ukrainians. I mean, in fact, if you're looking properly, you can see very clearly that America has already thrown the entirety of Europe under the bus. They don't care. I mean, at least the Europeans are starting to get some level of cognizance to recognize, to one extent or another anyway, even if it's after like 3 years of very obvious American-European divorce proceedings, the Europeans are starting to understand that there's America and there's the rest of the world, and that's it. But you still think that these people are your friends. And now you're begging for the U.S. to enter your war with Iran. But trust me, that's the absolute last thing that you need to have happen. You know, you're so used to the idea that escalation is always to your advantage, but that's not the case anymore. That's not the case this time, and it's not the case anymore. If there is escalation, it just brings you even faster to devastation. Like I said, what on earth do you have to protect? Think about it, honestly. What is there to protect when you know how the real game works in 2025? I mean, clearly you don't know how it works, so let me tell you. I mean, here's the calculation. A war-torn Israel is at least twice as attractive to investors than Israel intact. Come on, you know this. You know how investors see a war-torn Israel, how they see any war-torn country. They see opportunity. They don't see tragedy. They don't see collapse. They see opportunity, because that's what it is for them. Because when a state like Israel gets hit hard, gets hit fast, gets hit on multiple fronts, what you get isn't just the rubble. You get a liquidation event. You get distressed assets. You get regulatory suspension by the government. You get panic sale. You get state desperation. You get privatization writ large. That's war dividend. Before the war, Israel was expensive. Bloated asset prices. You had real estate in Tel Aviv was like the same as Manhattan. The tech sector was overheated. Regulation was heavy. Civil resistance was loud. You couldn't touch most of the markets unless you were already embedded in those markets or you were overpaying to participate in those markets. But after the war, everything flips. Property values plummet. Owners liquidate. The government fast-tracks permits. You know, permits that would normally take years. Zoning laws vanish under emergency conditions. And nobody's going to call it exploitation because it's reconstruction. Even better, the state needs you. You understand? The state needs you. Israel is going to hemorrhage public funds to rebuild. But of course, it can't foot the bill. They don't have that kind of money. They spent too much. So it sells their future off in bonds, in land, in long-term infrastructure deals. You understand? And who do you think has that kind of cash to buy all of that? Again, think it through, because it gets worse. Foreign capital, especially from the GCC, especially from the Gulf, is going to flood you. Not for solidarity, not for peace, but because devastation lowers resistance, and Arab money, Arab ownership, Arab residence, you know, in peace, gentrification gets protested, but in war, it's welcomed as salvation. Every Israeli by 2030 is going to be telling his new Arab landlords and his new Arab investors, you know, I was a peacenik back in the day. I was against the genocide. I protested Netanyahu. I'm an anti-Zionist. That's what you're going to be saying in 5-10 years. So when you think about how much more attractive Israel is for investors after war, now think about whether or not you really want America to escalate. Put it this way. If pre-war Israel intact, scores a 3 out of 10 on the return on investment risk-reward scale for cold capital, post-war, it jumps to 8 or 9. Because now you're not competing with legacy oligarchs anymore. They all left on their yachts. You watched them go. You're not going to be stuck in bureaucratic paralysis because you're the solution. You're the savior. You're the savior investor, angel investor. And the very people that you hyped up as your mortal enemies are going to be taking over with the help of the very people who promised to protect you against those same people. Welcome to Reconstruction. It's de-Zionization on an industrial scale. No, you aren't doing anything when you escalate this war, but accelerate the end of your own colonial project. You should be able to see that. No one's worried on our end. I mean, do you have any idea how much richer our countries are going to get as a result of your delusions of genocidal grandeur? Oh, and yes, it's going to be our money. Not loans, not gifts, not aid from the United States. Our money, our land, our dominion, our sovereignty. You know that saying in the Bible, your Judeo-Christian friends attribute it to Jesus, alayhi salam, in the Bible. The meek shall inherit the earth, they say. Well, a more accurate translation of the word meek is those who are gentle, who are humble, and who are disciplined in their strength. Those who do not assert themselves through violence. That's what meek means here. So the right way to say that passage in the Gospels, blessed are those who are patient. Blessed are those who are humble, with power under restraint, for the land will be theirs. That's what it said. But I know you don't believe any aspect of the Christian side of the Judeo-Christian equation, but that's fine. The Torah says the same thing. It says that those who are not arrogant shall inherit the land. They shall inherit the land, and they shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Or as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has promised to those among you who believe and who do righteous deeds that he will surely grant them succession in the land. So it doesn't matter which book you want to look at, which book you believe in. You and I both know that none of these refer to you, and none of these refer to the Americans, and none of these verses refer to the Westerners. No, there is only one nation that fits that description, and you know it and I know it. There's only one nation that is right now seeing that play out in the region. And you and I both know that it's the Muslims. And what you need to understand is that this is going to happen with or without a war with Iran. It's going to happen with or without escalation. It's going to happen with or without America entering the war. because this is just the trajectory. This is the way it's going. So you can either do it the easy way or the hard way. These are really your options. You're choosing to do it the hard way, but that's going to result in a much harder outcome for you. It's not going to result in a harder outcome for us. The easy way gives you a much more softer landing. Doing it the hard way, well, it's going to be a harder landing.
And that was Shahid Bolson. He recorded that on June 20th, 2025.